Age of Radio.
One of the most fundamental pieces of home brewing is developing a recipe. It's just a part of making an all-grain batch. Even if you have a kit, there's a recipe involved. So this week we're talking to Brad Segal. He's the head development brewer over at Northern Brewer, and we're going to talk about his approach to creating great recipes this week on Homebrewing DIY. Hey there, homebrewing DIY listeners. I'd like to talk to you about one of our finest sponsors and one of my favorite tools in my homebrew kit, and that's my hydrometer. The reason is that accuracy is so important, and I always take a boil, a pre-boil reading, and then I also take a OG, original gravity, and a final gravity reading, and I always do so on my Brewing America hydrometer. I had no idea how great of a tool it was until I had a high-quality hydrometer. I've gone through many, I've broken many, and then I found this tool that is of the most superb quality. And so if you head on over to homebrewingdiy.beer, use our sponsor banner, and you can get 15% off of your next Brewing America hydrometer. These are American-made, hand-blown here in the United States, and guaranteed to be perfectly calibrated when you receive it. So head on over to brewingamerica.com. Tell them that Homebrewing DIY sent you, or just use our banner. Either way, it'll let them know that we sent you. And welcome back to Homebrewing DIY, the podcast that takes on the do-it-yourself aspect of homebrewing, gadgets, contraptions, and parts. This show covers it all. On this week's show, we're talking to Brad Segal. He's the head development brewer over at Northern Brewer, and we're going to discuss with him what he does when he approaches formulating brand new beer recipes. It's a great conversation, and I highly recommend you stick around and listen to the interview. But first, I'd like to thank all of our patrons over at Patreon. It's because of you that this show can come to you week after week. Head on over to patreon.com/homebrewingdiy. It's very, very easy to donate and to support the show, and I want to thank all of our supporters. It's because of you. Really, you make this easy. And sorry about this coming out a little late in the week. I actually had this interview done, was just going to throw it together on my vacation. I even brought a microphone with me, but I had a issue while I was on my trip where I couldn't get my microphone to work. And so therefore I was lacking some power. And so I'm now back from vacation and knocking this out on a Sunday night. So it'll be a few days late. So apologize for that, but it is coming out this week. We will have a fresh new episode as well this coming Thursday, and very, very excited for you to hear that one as well. Another way to support the show is to head on over to Ko-fi. That's ko-fi.com/homebrewingdiy. There you can do one-time support. And another way to support the show is head on over to homebrewingdiy.beer and use our sponsor banners. Brewing America, all kinds of other things like Brewfather and all of our supporting sponsors. You click on those links and it lets them know that we sent you. Also, if you use Brewing America's link, just put in a coupon code for 15% off and they will give you a 15% discount from Homebrewing DIY. So very, very excited about being able to do that. Not too much going on in my home brewery. Obviously, I was on vacation last week. I've got a batch of beer that I brewed when I was doing the Pop Culture Brews podcast, which we're going to record later this month, and I'm going to go over with Andrew and taste his beer. So very excited to taste the beer that we made inspired by the room. So keep an eye out for that episode. And I also today whipped up a batch of kimchi that I'm going to ferment. It's actually out on the counter right now getting ready. I love fermented foods. Maybe I should do a show on fermented foods. I'd love to hear some feedback if that's something you would want to hear as a podcast topic. Well, let's just jump into this week's episode where we're going to talk to Brad Segal about recipe formulation. I'd like to welcome Brad Segal, not to be confused with Steven Segal, because he's, you know, not cool. And Brad is the head developmental brewer over at Northern Brewer. Welcome, Brad, to Homebrewing DIY.
Hey, Coulter, thanks for having me.
Hey, I asked you to be on the show, and just if you're listening to this podcast right now, just so you know, Brad has actually recorded an entire episode with me. We had some audio issues, and I had to call him back onto the show, and we're actually doing a re-record of our original interview, and thank you once again so much for doing that.
Absolutely. Wouldn't miss it.
Awesome. Well, now what we're going to talk about, and you are sounding so much better, we're going to dive into recipe development. And since you are kind of the developmental brewer, and you've come up with some of the recipes that I think that if you're a home brewer, at some point, I would say for a majority of home brewers out there, I'm not going to say every home brewer, at some point, you've made somebody's made a Northern Brewer kit in your orbit, or you have yourself. I know I have personally. And so some of those recipes were developed by you and your team. I'd love to talk about just, you know, the approach to recipe development and all of the kind of, what that approach looks like. So to get started, I'd love to hear a bit of background on how you got into homebrewing, how you ended up at Northern Brewer, and then let's dive into recipe development. So how'd you start homebrewing?
Well, that's a pretty good story, actually. It was back in, I believe, 2007. One of my buddies had moved to Colorado, and he moved to Denver, and he had stored some stuff in the garage of the house I was living in. And as it turns out, one of those items that was in the garage was an old Mr. Beer kit, how so many of us do start. And I had noticed that the And I had noticed that the yeast was expired. So I went on a wild goose chase to find a new pack of yeast. And I discovered that Northern Brewer was pretty much right down the street for me. And so never actually made the Mr. Beer kit. Instead, got the whole 5-gallon starter kit and dove head in, did a few extract kits, and the rest is history.
And you kind of turned that hobby, obviously, into a career. Well, why don't you tell me a bit about that journey and how you kind of ended up working at Northern Brewer?
Well, it's a bit serendipitous in and of itself. After the first two batches, I believe I did, I just went back into the homebrew shop. And I just said, hey, are you looking for any part-time help? I was already employed at the time, but the allure of home brewing, it really got to me. And so I asked to perhaps come in, work a few shifts here and there. And before I knew it, I just started coming in every day and nobody really said anything. And so that became my job. And that was 2008.
That's awesome. It's kind of one of those things where it's like, oh, we got to pay this guy to do this?
Yeah. I was like, really? They're paying me to do this?
That's awesome. And you turned it into a career. Obviously, you probably worked the front of the shop for a long time. You still currently work the front of the shop, or what are you doing day to day right now?
Well, day to day, I am actually in our headquarters, which is our shipping warehouse and offices. So I am no longer in the retail setting. So I am in the headquarters, and I have a desk, but my area is basically like a geek brew lab where I have every single piece of equipment we could ever want. You know, when we come up with new products, I get to test them out. And so I kind of work in a brewing wonderland.
Well, aren't you the luckiest guy in homebrewing right now?
Oh, man. I can't believe this happened, and I will never take it back for anything. It's awesome.
That is awesome. Well, I'd love to talk to you about recipe development, and let's look at this through the beginner's eyes, right? Obviously, to me and to you, hey, I'm going to make this style of beer. Let's just whip out some brewing software or just jot down some notes of what I'm going to throw in there. I think that after years of homebrewing, you get to a place where recipe development just becomes kind of second nature. But if you're just starting out and you start to see a list of ingredients, you don't really see a lot of the themes that a lot of recipes have.
Right.
And so let's start with a very simple beer. Let's think something like maybe a Kolsch or something that doesn't have a lot to it, or maybe a simple pale ale. I think a simple pale ale is always a great one.
Sure.
What would you say is the best way to, you know, when thinking of recipe development, I'm going to make my own recipe of a simple pale ale. What kind of approaches could you talk about? Not necessarily like, yeah, you could give me a list of ingredients, but what kind of approaches would you talk to me more about, like in a theoretical way, right? Like,
sure.
What are you trying to achieve, and how is the simplest way to get there?
Sure. Well, it's something like a pale ale, you know, it's something like a Sierra Nevada, for example. You know, you're going to get a nice clean malt base with a little bit of caramel kind of nuances to it and a clean fermentation profile. So if you don't taste a whole lot of fruity esters in a commercial beer you'd like to sort of emulate like a pale ale, it's, you know, base malt or gold malt extract or something simple and a little bit of carbo malt. And this may sound a little cliche, but sometimes you just got to know the ingredients and know the flavors of what these ingredients bring. And that does come with experience. But when you are starting out, it is just so much easier to keep things simple. You know, don't try to combine too many ingredients, because that way, when you have a beer that you've brewed, and if you've thrown, you know, 6 malts in there and 5 different varieties of hops, you're never going to know what ingredient is providing what flavor. And so I really like to keep things simple. So for like an American pale ale, you know, some sort of American base malt, whether it be 2-row or malt extract. And then, you know, you look at a commercial example and it's got a nice kind of deep golden to slightly reddish hue to it. And that's going to be from caramel malt. And you just kind of experiment, put a little bit of caramel malt in there in your base malt, ferment it with a clean yeast, something like American ale, Chico strain, and start with a one hop variety, you know, for example, Cascade. And that way, when you have your final beer, you can actually taste it and you can pick out those individual flavors. Like, oh, I've got this really nice clean malt base. And then here's a little bit of caramel type flavor to it with a beautiful orange hue, and then slightly fruity hops. And yeah, that's my entire kind of mantra, is, you know, the old adage of keep it simple, stupid, the old KISS principle, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's the best approach. I mean, essentially what you're talking about there, as far as a malt bill goes, right, is essentially 2 ingredients on the malt bill and then 1 ingredient on the hops. And if something goes wrong, it's very, very easy to analyze what went wrong, right?
Correct.
I think the best advice given to me by my local homebrew shop when I first went all grain and I wanted to make my first recipe, I was like, hey, I want to go all grain. I don't know where to start. And the guy at the front desk, really great guy, comes up to me and he says, you know what? Just do a smash beer, because doing a smash beer lets you do an all grain beer. It won't taste bad, right? He's like, it won't taste bad. And you've got no variables. Here's some base malt. Here's one hop. Go nuts, right? And what's your thoughts on, you know, if you're going to start off on building your first recipe, what do you think about smash beers?
I think that is sage advice from that homebrew employee or the shop owner. It's that way, the fewer variables you have, the much easier it is to pick out what has either gone wrong, or maybe you don't like this particular hop, or you know, something of that nature. Start simple. That way it's really probably the best way to start gaining knowledge and insight into what specific ingredients taste like and how they interact together. So I love the idea of a smash beer. Always a good idea.
Yeah, my I would say my first three or four all grain batches were different varieties of smash beer, and they were for me to kind of get the idea of the different base malts. I didn't really go at it thinking hops were a second thing for me, and I made, I would say until I was on my sixth all grain batch, that was the first time I had a beer, and it was a smash beer, and I drank it and I was like, wow, this is actually a good beer. I could see myself drinking this, right?
Oh yeah.
And it was, but it was that trial and error. It was the, and it was really just getting my fermentation process down and getting all of that kind of dialed. And then recipe formulation kind of came second, right? And as we get more complex, what would you say are some good resources to go to when you're getting more complex and want to and do some more formulation of your own recipes style-wise? What would be some good resources you would go to?
Sure, just gathering some ideas, like what other people have been brewing. You can look at the Homebrewers Association. You can look at John Palmer, Jamil Zainashef's book, How to Brew. That's been a great resource for me over the years. The BJCP, or the Beer Judge Certification Program, if you look at those guidelines, it will tell you, you know, like the common ingredients used in that beer. It'll give you the guidelines, like how strong it should be, what your gravity should be, what your IBU should be. And if you kind of take all those resources and aggregate them together, you can start to form this picture of exactly what goes in, say, a pale ale versus an IPA, or a porter versus a stout. And you can start to learn those nuances and just really build off of that. I'd say the more you read, the more you look at the resources available all over the internet, you're going to start to form this idea of where to go, what direction to start heading in. And that's when you start to experiment and iterate.
Yeah. And one thing that I like, and I love that you started off saying, hey, keep it simple, stupid. What kind of, like, for example, and I know you don't work on the retail side, but I know you did at some point, right?
I sure did.
And you would see homebrewers come in with like these recipes, and they'd be like, I need to make this thing. And they would have like little itty bitty amounts like that probably are negligible, period, right?
1 ounce of biscuit malt, or yeah.
Yeah, exactly that, right? Which if you're doing a 1 gallon batch, probably does something.
Would be fine.
But if you're doing a 5 gallon batch, it's probably not doing much at all, right?
Right.
And so what would you, and I see that all the time. I'll see recipes that are kind of shared with me, and they'll be like, hey, I'm thinking about making this beer. And I will see recipes that are maybe trying to do a clone, and they're trying to scale it down from like a huge batch or something like that. And you end up with these recipes that have really, I would say, like a base malt, and then they have like 15 different specialty malts in them or something like that, right? And and to me, it's like that type of a recipe ends up becoming over complex. And I think you said it earlier where you're like, hey, if there's something that goes wrong, it's hard to figure out what went wrong. Would you say that when you are making a beer and you do keep it more of a simple malt bill, do you feel that you can still achieve your same goals? Like, let's say you're trying to hit it. Another way I would say it is you see it in like brewing software. Hey, I have to get to this exact IBU. I have to get to this exact SRM because they're trying to fall within some certain style guidelines.
Sure.
I personally feel don't get super caught up in that and try to get as close as you can, but it doesn't have to be perfect. Would you agree with that same kind of statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Most of the time, commercial recipes don't scale down quite that well. And I like to start simple because you can always brew another batch and add something, because then you can taste what that next ingredient might add. But you can never take anything out of a beer if you don't know what it tastes like, because there's so many other grains in there.
Ah, that's a great way of putting it. Way better than my long-winded way of putting it.
Yeah. start simple and build up from there. And then eventually, and absolutely don't get too caught up in, you know, SRM and IBU and, you know, your bitterness to your gravity to bitterness ratio, or other way around. Don't get too caught up in that. Brew a beer, try it. If you like it, if you want to add, maybe, you know, make it a little bit darker, change up your malts a little bit next time, you know, just keep going and change one thing at a time. And don't get too caught up in the style guidelines. If it's a beer you like, who cares? Who cares if it makes any sort of certain style?
Yeah, like, and if we're even in competition beers, one of my favorite pieces of advice in competition beers is submit the beer that's in the glass. Don't submit the beer you intended it to be, right?
That is exactly correct.
You know, it's like, taste the beer. Hey, I was going for a stout, but for some reason it came out to be 5%, and this is a great porter. So submit it as a porter. That's okay.
Yeah. What does it taste like? You know, look at those style guidelines and just try to match up. Like, don't force it. You know, don't think you're brewing a stout. I mean, yes, you can think you're brewing a stout, but if it doesn't quite taste like a stout, maybe it's a little bit sweeter. Maybe it's got a little bit less body, or vice versa, whatever. Enter it into a competition how it tastes, not what it's intended to be.
Yeah. And I've made that mistake over the years, right? Hey, I was trying to make this beer. It didn't come out perfect. And as we all know, when we're doing competition beers, that's when you're like, all right, every little detail matters, right? I'm submitting this to a competition, and I'm going to put oxygen in it, and I'm going to do this beer perfectly. And you get through the whole process, and then because it's, you know, beer is a processed beverage, it doesn't always, even with the best intentions, doesn't always turn out exactly the way you imagine it to. And so
sometimes, like, what the hell did I just make here? This is delicious, but it's not what I was intending.
Exactly. And I did that once and ended up winning a gold medal. So it's because I submitted what was in the glass. And
that's the way to do it.
And God knows I got many scathing score sheets out over the years for submitting something that wasn't in the glass, right? So,
you're not alone there. I've got stacks of them somewhere, and I've gotten some pretty bad scores over the years.
That's all part of the process, man. It is.
And you just can't get discouraged. That's the biggest thing to take away from that.
Exactly. And the best way to put it is, you know, you don't make great beer without making a few bad beers along the way. And
it's inevitable.
It's inevitable. And in the end, they're all beer and they're all safe to drink because it's beer. And you could just pretty much, you know, go nuts with it. And I will admit, I have had a few that I've had to dump out, but I've made way more beers that haven't had to dump out. Right. So it's all part of the process.
It sure is. It sure is. Like, I've dumped probably at least 100 gallons over the years. Something didn't go right. You know, it just, wow, this is a flawed thought process. I should never put these ingredients together. You know, I've dumped beer. It's just a part of, it's just a part of brewing.
I've done some hop combos, and I have this, I've been trying to brew a British style golden ale for years and have never nailed it. And every time it's come out to be bad. And so, and it's not that I'm putting in the wrong ingredients. It's just like every time I make that beer, I have something go wrong with the fermentation and I get some crazy weird off flavor. So it's kind of one of those, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, that's my Achilles heel. Let's talk a bit about, in this, since we are talking about recipe formulation, let's talk about some good tips and tricks for things like, you know, one of my favorite tricks for great recipe formulation where you still keep things simple, but you want to add complexity. So let's say we're doing a very, very simple beer. I love to use Kolsch as an example because Kolsch tends to have very few ingredients, right? It's mainly base malt, usually has a single hop. It could be Kolsch's there are smash beers that make great Kolsch's. You know, obviously you're going to use Kolsch yeast. But one thing that I love to do when trying to add complexity to a beer is I love blending base malts. And could you give me some examples of some beers that you've made where you've taken some base malts and have blended them together to really good results? And what are some of those combinations?
Absolutely. excuse me. I really, really love, especially in IPAs, like I oftentimes, as a baseline, I'll brew an IPA with, say, just standard two-row American malt. And the hops just really can overtake, and you don't really get a whole lot of malt body. So one great combination is, you know, take 50-50 two-row and mix that with Maris Otter or Golden Promise, or maybe 20% Vienna malt, 10% Munich malt, something like that. It just gives it a little bit more of the gusto on the malt side. It's not so one-dimensional. It's not a one-trick pony anymore. It's got some malt characters that actually stand up to the hops. So blending base malts is always wonderful. Love it. And it works in pretty much any style.
Yeah, yeah.
Even Kolsch.
Even Kolsch. For me, it's when I do a lot of German-style lagers, I tend to always blend base malts, right? Example would be I have a Munich Helles recipe that I love, and it's obviously Pilsner, but then I also have, you know, and it's got some Munich in it, but I love to throw a little Vienna in there, right? And
Vienna's probably because
Vienna's probably one of my favorite malts ever in the world. And
absolutely.
If I ever could find an excuse to put Vienna in something, I just do. It is it's so good. But it's funny how people think, oh, it's just baseball. No, Vienna is not just baseball, guys.
This is special stuff.
It's special stuff. And it does. It adds a different kind of character. It's something where I've put it in American beers, I've put it in German style beers, and it's just one of my favorite go-to malts. And probably because Vienna lager is probably one of my favorite lagers as well. But
did you read my mind right there?
Oh, are we on the same page here? I love Vienna lager too.
I think so.
Yeah. And but to me it's something where that malt is, if I can throw it in there, it's kind of my secret ingredient. And it's not so secret anymore. But for me, the blending of base malts is such a good way to add complexity, but it still keeps your beer simple, right? So example would be a 50-50 base malt split, a 25%. You don't have to necessarily get into it being like, oh, hey, I'm going to add 3 ounces of this base malt in here. It can be a significant amount of that grist, right?
Absolutely. Vienna is not aggressive enough that it would really overtake the flavor of any beer, say a pale ale, IPA. You know, it works wonderfully in porters and stouts and darker beers like that. So yeah, don't just go pinching a little, you know, few kernels into your grain bill. Go ahead and put 10-20% in there and see how you like it, because I really think you will.
Yeah. It's delicious. And Munich is also another base malt that I love to add to some of my base malt combinations. And the cool thing about Munich is you can get it in some different shades, right? And so sometimes where you're maybe going for that kind of redder color, but you don't want to have that caramel flavor, maybe the darker Munich could be a good addition to that, right?
Yeah, like Weirmann Dark Munich. I think it comes in, off the top of my head, I want to say it's almost 20 love.
Yeah,
that'll give you some great color without getting those the caramel nuances to it. So it's still a clean malt base, but it's got the color and it's got that almost slightly toasty bread character to it as well.
Yeah. What are some other great tips when it comes to hop combinations when you're doing recipe formulations? What would you say are some of your do's and don'ts there?
I'd say don't mix Noble and New Age American hops. That gets really weird real quick. So say Fuggle and Citra. It's going to be like a fruit salad that was rubbed in the dirt. So stay away from things like that. Otherwise, you know, keep like hops together. Oftentimes, if you're doing something, a recipe that calls for Noble-type hops, like Spalter, Hallertau, those things play together really well because you can get the floral character, a little bit of spicy, a little bit of earthiness. And likewise, if you flip the other side of the ocean, American hop varieties, say something like Mosaic and Centennial, do really well together. I also really like to do fruity and piney American hops. So Columbus or Chinook mixed with Centennial or, you know, Mosaic or something like that. It just kind of gives this awesome balance of kind of resiny pine dank and fruity and tropical. Those play really, really well together.
Gin. You just made gin.
Yeah. nothing wrong with gin.
Nothing wrong with gin. But I'm just saying that's where if you're thinking in your head, hey, where have you seen that before? Citrus and pine and gin are mm-hmm. a very, very common combination. And you're just essentially doing that same thing with hops, right?
It doesn't seem awfully intuitive, but man, let me tell you, it works out. That's that classic West Coast IPA thing. It's got the pine, it's got the resin, it's got the fruity citrus. It works great.
It does. And then obviously we're now in a world of like the hazy IPA, and I think that they tend to feature hop combinations a lot now, but mm-hmm. a lot of those tend to be those kind of juicy hop combinations, right?
Correct.
And are there any kind of out of the, you know, obviously we all know the classic is like, you know, Citra, if you took Citra and Mosaic and probably Amarillo and threw those together, we all know those are going to be a really good hop combo. What are some out of the box kind of hop combos in that juicy realm where people may not think that that's kind of going to work, but it does?
Well, sometimes I don't think people understand how fruity and like citrusy Columbus can be. It often gets this bad rap as being kind of catty and diesel-y. But done with other hops that can accentuate that fruit character, Columbus plays really well. And also, one hop that I've really been in love with lately is Zappa. It's not exactly easy to find, but it's kind of a hop that has all of those characters in it together. And Zappa and Idaho 7, it may sound weird, but those go really well together in a New England IPA. It's a pretty crazy flavor. It's hard to describe, really. It's fruity. It's a little bit minty. It's a little bit resinous. But it's fruity. And Columbus is one of those that when I discovered that, it kind of took me aback for a second.
Yeah, and Columbus is a very easy hop to find as well, and
yes.
a lot easier on the pocketbook when you think about some of these juicy hops that, you know.
Right.
My neighbor across the street just spent $50 on a it's not cryo hops, but it's the other. Come on, come to me.
Oh man,
it's kind of like cryo hops, but it was Citra.
I can't think of it at the moment either. Yeah, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, me too. He bought a pound of it, and it was like $50 for a pound, right? Ooh. And of course, you know, he's making hazy IPAs and blowing through it, right? Because you're also talking about the amount of hops that go into one of those is just off the charts, right? In comparison to the old days of, remember when, you know, you were like, I put 3 ounces of hops in here, and they were all at 60 minutes, and this thing was like 100 IBUs. And now
you
we're
did
like,
what?
Yeah, I know. And everybody was like, and now we're at, I put a half a pound of hops in this, and it was all dry hopped.
come a long way.
Yeah, and we're talking 5 gallon batches, right? And if you scale that up to the like major brewery level, we're talking about huge hop contracts here. And so it's something where the amount of hops that are going into beers now is just on a completely different level.
Nobody ever would have thought this like even 10 years ago.
No, it's just insane. And the crazy part is they're putting that many hops in there, and the IBUs are still just, you know, they're not. They're not 100 plus IBU beers. We're talking like,
you're,
you know,
drinking
maybe 40.
An IPA with 20, 20 to 40. It's in like pale ale range, but the hop character, the flavors, the aromas, that's what gets you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very cool, I think it's a cool style, but then, you know, obviously I'm a homebrewing show, and I'm always like, hey, what's the next big thing? Because I'm now to where that IPA is the common, right? And so what is the next big thing? And What would you say, you know, obviously you're in the brewing development world, and I'm not telling you to pick out the next big thing, but what kind of styles are kind of standing out to you right now that you think are up and coming styles that we might see here over the next year or so?
Well, this one has been around for a while. I just don't really think it's made the mainstream a whole lot, but I've been very captivated by the Italian style Pilsner as of late. And I do plan to do quite a bit of those and release a kit. I have no idea when it's coming out, but it will be coming out at some point. I'm a bit of a pills nerd myself, so that one really makes me happy. Dry hop Pilsner, love it. And I think that'll be the big thing. Or lagers in general, I'd love to see lagers make a huge resurgence, whether it be Oktoberfest, Bock, Vienna, Schwarzbier. I think craft lagers is where things might be going.
Yeah. I'm seeing that locally here in Denver, right? There's obviously breweries like Bierstadt with their slow poured pills, and it's a very sought after beer, right? And it's kind of funny how it all came around, right? We started with these, like, you know, pale, crappy, big beer lagers, right? And craft is now coming back. I feel like craft right now is coming back to lager and really just letting it be what it is. For me,
it's a long, slow, full circle.
Oh, it is a long, full circle. But on the other side of that, these Pilsners are so good right now, right? Like, they're not the great ones are great, and they have flavor, and they have the best way I like to describe the modern Pilsner right now is that it's all process, right? It's 100% process beer, and if you've got a really great process at a small brewery level, you can make amazing lagers, and I think that a lot of the beers that have got us here, right, are those great brewers that were all those process driven breweries are starting to finally kind of get the kudos they're due, because they're you can't have a mediocre brewer hiding behind a ton of IBUs or a ton of juicy hops, right?
Yeah, you can hide a lot of flaws in beers that have that much flavor profile, but in something like a Pilsner, like, you got nowhere to hide. Those ingredients are
nowhere.
Pretty cut and dry. You got Pilsner malt, and you got some Hallertauer, Spalt, Tettnang. And if you don't know what you're doing, if you don't get your pitch rates right, if you don't get your pH right, if you don't get your temperatures right, the timing right, it's not going to be what it should. So I think a great Pilsner is a mark of a very, very good brewer.
Yeah. And just... for an FYI, we actually just dropped an entire article on homebrewing DIY dedicated to the Italian Pilsner just this week.
It's a great article. I read it.
Oh, you did?
Read it
great.
A few times. Yeah.
It's a good one. It's one of those things where I've seen a few Italian Pilsner examples locally that are just stellar beers. And I'm excited to, and I've got some guys in my homebrew club that are making some, and I'm excited to try them. But I think that Italia Pilsner is definitely, at least if we're going to talk about the beer of this summer for me, it's definitely going to be that beer. I also, and this is maybe one we could talk a bit about process, is I'm starting to see a bit of a resurgence in ice beers. Have you seen a bit of that at all?
I have. There's been a few breweries here in the Twin Cities. I've seen them do some ice beers. In fact, a coworker and myself, we fully intended to ice a Maibock when we had a nasty cold spell here in Minneapolis. And as soon as it was done fermenting, it got into the 30s. So that got shot right out the window, unfortunately. But it's a lost style almost. It's a lost technique.
Yeah, it is. And well, you know, we had beers like, you know, Ice House and Bud Ice and all, you know, Big Beer took it on for a minute and I think kind of, you know, gave it a bad name. But to me,
that was a marketing gimmick.
Totally marketing gimmick. But to me, the actual true style of an ice beer is something where you can get into things like Imperial Pilsners, right? You can really take a great beer. You can bump up the alcohol because you're ice distilling it. and really just kind of, once again, make a process-driven beer, but still kind of get this kind of, you know, bump up the ABV and still have it be a crisp, clean finishing beer. And so, I'm excited. I've got a friend who works at a brewery that's about to release an entire line of ice beers, and I'm very excited to try those. So,
I should fly out to Denver.
we'll keep in touch. I might be able to send you some.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, I'm overdue to get out there anyhow.
Well, if you ever come to Denver, we are definitely hanging out.
Awesome.
But yeah, so let's recap. So let's talk about some approaches to good recipe formulation. First of all, keep it simple. Simple grain bills are always going to be better. I love the advice where you talk about dive into the style guidelines and talk about how things should taste and the feel. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great piece of advice, because people always say, hey, find this book full of recipes, right? Yeah, you can start there. But I also think that if you compare that with the style guidelines, there you go. You've got the blend of the two sides of it, right?
Exactly.
It's like, hey, here's the list of ingredients, but also here's how it's supposed to taste on the other side, right?
Yeah, don't take all your stuff from one source. You know, just do some research. You know, you don't have to dive in too deep, but look at the guidelines, you know, read a few books, look at different recipes, and eventually it'll coalesce in your mind, and you can start getting a better idea of what goes into what beer, and then you start simple and add from there.
Exactly. And then one last question. What kind of beers are you working on at Northern Brewer right now? What are we going to see here in the soon future for available for a customer?
Well, I have been working with actually a freshly released Omega strain, which I'm pretty excited about. It is it is one of their new fancy ones that they did some work on genetically. It's pretty awesome. I'm kegging that tomorrow, in fact. And I use that with the Cryopop, the new cryo blend. So I'm expecting some pretty, pretty awesome flavors off of that one. And also, I have been working on a foreign extra stout. That one I'm pretty happy about.
Yeah, I haven't had a foreign stout in a really long time.
I feel like it's almost a lost style. It's got to be resurged. It's got to come back.
Yeah, I mean, there obviously when you go to the Caribbean, you see a lot of the like foreign beers, right? The bottles of Guinness that you get in the Caribbean always remind me of that foreign stout, right? It's like that black, almost kind of lagerish, but it's a Guinness and it's kind of weird, and that's usually where I've drank commercial examples of that. But it's definitely, it's not an easy beer to find here in the States.
No, it's not. No, it's not. So yeah. that was basically the impetus behind developing that recipe. So I'm still working on it. I don't exactly know when it'll come out, because I'm not going to release anything I'm not perfectly happy with myself. But it will be released at some point. Fret not.
That's awesome. Well, hey, Brad, the guy with the coolest job in the world, I want to thank you for coming on my show and talking to us about some of the ways that you do recipe formulation. And obviously, if somebody wanted to maybe run a question by you, what's the best way to reach you?
You can email brewmaster@northernbrewer.com and just say hey, this is a question for Brad, and they will forward it on to me, and I will do my best to satisfy your curiosities.
That's awesome. Well, hey, thank you for coming on Homebrewing DIY, and when you come to Denver, we're definitely getting a beer.
Oh, no doubt. Coulter, thanks so much for having me. Great opportunity. Had a lot of fun. Too bad we had to re-record, but whatever, we're still talking about beer.
I'd like to thank Brad for taking the time to come on the show. Yeah, like you said, we had to do this show twice because I had a recording issue. It was actually on his end, and it was really nice of him to come back and get re-mic'd up with a new one and actually sounded a lot better. So, Brad, thank you so much. And you can always find him over at Northern Brewer if you have any questions. Well, that's it for this week, and we'll talk to you next week on Homebrewing DIY.